Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 2 Samuel chapter 15. We're going to do the whole long chapter, 37 verses today. And the title of this chapter will be David Flees Jerusalem During Absalom's Rebellion. Our context is this. In the last chapter, Absalom, who had been in retreat, in exile in Geshur, east of the Sea of Galilee, for 2 years because he had killed Amnon, David's oldest son and heir to the throne, during a sheep-shearing festival. And he had been reconciled to David in the last chapter. And now he's going to repay that leniency on the part of David with a revolt. So we start now in verses 1 through 6 of 2 Samuel 15. Now it came about after this reconciliation in the last chapter, after this, that Absalom provided for himself a chariot and horses and 50 men as runners before him. Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way to the gate, and when any man had a suit to come to the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "From what city are you?" And he would say, "Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "See, your claims are good and right, but no man listens to you on the part of the king." Therefore, moreover, Absalom would say, "Oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land, then every man who has any suit or cause would come to me, and I would give him justice." And when a man came near to prostrate himself before him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. In this manner Absalom dealt with all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. Now, why did Absalom have a chariot for himself? Well, that's to make himself look grand and respectable among the people, along with those horses and runners, those 50 runners that he had running before him. All of this is for pomp and ceremony and show. He may have gotten the chariots from his grandfather at Geshur. The horses are actually very rare in Israel. As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown that say, quote, "Horses are, quote, a novelty among the Hebrew people, only introduced in that age as an appendage of royalty." So wherever he got them from, he's parading them about. And then, in verse 2, he starts stealing people's allegiance away from David by offering them justice in the courts. He got up early in the morning. This is, that little detail is given there to show how diligent Absalom was in helping out the people, but also it could be because legal business in the east was always conducted in the morning, and that's what Absalom is doing here. He's interfering in David's legal system. He went to the gate, and of course the gate is where legal proceedings were customarily carried out, the gate of the city. Now, in verse 3, Absalom would say to a suitor, "See, your claims are good and right, but no man listens to you on the part of the king." Well, that sounds pretty blatantly offensive. An open affront to David's authority, as the NIV Study Bible puts it. So why did David allow it? Well, here's some options. Maybe he was too indulgent as a father. We know that, as a matter of fact. He didn't do anything to Amnon when Amnon raped his own daughter, Tamar. He didn't track Absalom down when he went to Geshur. Well, that might have been a little hard to do. Might have started a war, but he didn't seem to really do anything about Absalom. And then he brought him back, despite the fact that Absalom had paid no price for his crime of murder. So yeah, he was too indulgent a father. But now we could say this. Perhaps David's judicial system may have actually had some defects. And as John Gill says, the king had grown old himself. His sons were negligent and do not attend to business. There's no one besides them appointed to hear causes. So here I am. Absalom says, "I'm here to take care of you because you can't get your day in court." So it could be that Absalom is just making reformist comments about the judicial system. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says this, quote, "Studiously concealing his ambitious designs, he expressed a wish to be invested with official power, only that he might accelerate the course of justice and advance the public interest. His professions had an air of extraordinary generosity and disinterestedness." Well, let's put it this way. He might have sounded like he was just trying to reform the judicial system, but he was definitely making a play for power, political power, and he was doing it at the expense of the legitimate King David, his father. In short, he was a jerk. So we go now to verses 7 through 9 in 2 Samuel 15. "Now it came about at the end of 40 or 4 years, depending on your translation. Now it came about at the end of 4 years that Absalom said to the king, 'Please let me go and pay my vow, which I vow to the Lord in Hebron. For your servant vowed a vow while I was living at Geshur in Aram, saying, If the Lord shall indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord.' The king said to him, 'Go in peace.' So he arose," that's Absalom, "arose and went to Hebron." Now I said 40 years or 4 years is the time frame here. The NIV and the Holman Christian Study Bible have 4. The NIV note says that some Septuagint manuscripts in the Syriac and Josephus and the Hebrew, the Masoretic text, say 40 years. This is what Adam Clark says about that. There is no doubt that this reading of 40 is corrupt, though supported by the commonly printed Vulgate, the Septuagint. The Syriac has 4 years. The Arabic has 4 years. Josephus has 4 years. The 16th edition of the Vulgate has 4 years. And several manuscripts of the Vulgate have 4 years. Theodoret has 4 years. Most learned men are of the opinion that it's 4 years because 40 is an error. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say it is generally admitted that an error has here crept into the text, and that instead of 40, we should read with the Syriac and Arabic versions and Josephus 4 years. All right, so it's 4 years. If you do take it's 40 years, well, then that could be from the time that David reconciled with Absalom. I find that hard to believe. 40, he's reconciled for 40 years. David's so old he can hardly breathe, and Absalom's late in age, and he has a rebellion. I don't think so. But it could be from the time of David's being anointed by Samuel, 40 years, because he was anointed as a teenager, and then he went to work in Saul's court, and then he rebelled against Saul. Saul basically kicked him out of the kingdom, and he ran around in the desert for a while, and then he became king at Hebron for a while, then he was king of Jerusalem for a while, so that could be 40 years. It could be Absalom's 48 years old at the end of Absalom's 40 years. I think it's 4 years. Okay, so we'll go with 4 years. Later, Absalom says to the king, please let me go and pay my vow, which I vowed to the Lord. Now, you know, Hebrews are always making vows, thank offerings, and that sort of thing. Thank offerings and vow offerings. They were a particular kind of peace offerings. Now, he's probably lying about having done that. Usually, you made a vow offering. You say, God, if you will do this, and then when God does it, then you go pay your vow offering. A thank offering was if God just did something nice for you, and you hadn't asked for it, but he did something nice, and you say, I'll thank you for it, and you give a vow offering. But whatever it was, Absalom was probably lying about it, because he's plotting a rebellion. But the king doesn't know. David says, go in peace, and down to Hebron Absalom goes. Hebron, of course, is about 17 miles south of Jerusalem. Now, why did Absalom want to start the conspiracy there? Well, Hebron was a logical place to perform a vow. Absalom had been born there, and so it would not look suspicious that he would go back to his hometown. Plus, there was a famous high place there. Sacrifices were often offered in high places before Solomon built his temple. Hebron would also have good associations for the people because David had been anointed king there, as you recall. He ruled there for 7 years before he took over the northern 11 tribes. Hebron was far enough away from Jerusalem to keep Absalom's conspiracy secret. And the NIV study Bible adds, perhaps there's a party in Hebron who was originally opposed to moving the capital to Jerusalem when David moved it to Jerusalem. There's always people that don't like things to change when it costs them political power. So there was a lot of good reasons that Absalom would go to Hebron. So we go down to verse 10, 2 Samuel 15. But Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom is king in Hebron. Now, other translations don't have spies. The NIV has secret messengers. The NASB has spies, but the NIV has secret messengers were sent throughout all the tribes of Israel by Absalom. Holman Christian Study Bible says just messengers were sent. Well, why did Absalom send these spies / messengers? Gil, Clark, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say the purpose was to sound out the disposition of the people towards Absalom. Well, if that's the case, then spies would actually be a better translation than secret messengers. He's trying to find out what's going on. So we assume that Absalom is engaged in full-scale treason here. He's got his own spy network. And then he tells these spies, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom is king in Hebron. That's the coordination part. Well, how's he going to coordinate all through Israel at a time when there's no communication? The sound of the trumpet? One trumpet's going to be heard over the whole country? Not likely. John Gill said that Absalom probably employed men to sound a trumpet in many places, and Adam Clark says probably one trumpet was blown after the preceding trumpet was blown, and the signal was relayed all across the country, kind of like signal fires. That's how they used to communicate in the olden days. We go to 2 Samuel 15, 11 through 12. 200 men from Jerusalem went with Absalom down to Hebron to perform this so-called offering that Absalom was making. These 200 men had been invited and were going innocently, for they knew nothing about the whole matter. While he, that's Absalom, was offering the sacrifices, Absalom sent for David's advisor Ahithophel the Gilonite from his city of Gilo. So the conspiracy grew strong, and the people supporting Absalom continued to increase. Now, these 200 men that went with Absalom, who didn't know about the conspiracy, Gill says they were probably some of the leading men in Jerusalem. And Gill also says that when the conspiracy started, this would make David look very bad when Absalom came out of the woodwork and proclaimed himself as king. And David's going to look around, oh my goodness, 200 of my leading nobles are now with the bad guy, the rebel, the conspirator. Adam Clark says, on the other hand, these 200 men were soldiers. I think they were probably big shots, leading nobles. I think Gill might be right on that. Now, even though they knew nothing about the whole matter when they went down to Hebron, John Gill speculates that nevertheless, some of them were probably drawn into the conspiracy. And even if they weren't, this is my thought here, even if they weren't drawn into the conspiracy, these leading men provided cover for the conspiracy because people would look and say, well, you know, there must be a big deal here. Must be that Absalom needs to be king because all of David's leading nobles are supporting him, it looks like. And of course, one of the worst defectors from David was Ahithophel the Gilonite. Why was he of special importance? Well, Absalom was going to use him to find out David's secrets because Ahithophel was David's advisor. In fact, John Gill says Ahithophel was considered to be David's best counselor. I don't know how Gill knows that. I take his word. Adam Clark says Absalom, quote, in effect, got the prime minister of the kingdom to join him. The rabbis say that Ahithophel may have been the grandfather of Bathsheba, and thus may have held a grudge against David for what he had done to Bathsheba. That's wonderful speculation. I put no stock in it. I just note it as a point of history here. It's kind of interesting that rabbis would say that. But Ahithophel was one of David's advisors, and he defects to Absalom. He's from the city of Gilo. Gilo means exile. Easton's dictionary says that Gilo was a city in the southwest part of the hill country of Judah. And if I look at BibleAtlas.org, as I said earlier, Hebron is 17 miles south of Jerusalem. And then if you go about 5, maybe a little bit more, maybe 6 miles to the north of Hebron on the road that runs from Bethlehem to Hebron, from Jerusalem to Bethlehem to Hebron, about 6 miles north and northwest of Hebron, you end up at Gilo. So Ahithophel is from the general area of Judah, David's home tribe. Verse 12 says that Absalom's people that were supporting him continued to increase. Why was Absalom able to increase his political power? Here's some suggestions. His personal appearance, for one thing. John Gill says this, quote, people were, quote, being drawn to him by the comeliness of his person, his affable behavior, the pomp and magnificence in which he appeared. Also, John Gill mentions the great number, 200, of the principal inhabitants of Jerusalem who had come down with Absalom. Absalom was also the king's eldest son, and so he was heir to the crown. He was the crown prince. That would attract people to him. John Gill suggests also that perhaps a rumor was spreading that Solomon was to be designated heir, and people might not like that. Solomon, his mother, is an adulteress. Bathsheba, we don't want him as our king. We want Absalom. Besides, Absalom's the oldest heir apparent. Now, all of this increasing of discontent with David and increase of support for Absalom shows that David's government had engendered a lot of deep discontent. As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown point out, they say this, quote, the remnant of Saul's partisans, that's the people that were fighting David before the kingdom was reunited, right after David died, the unhappy affair of Bathsheba, the overbearing insolence and crimes of Joab, that's David's general who was an SOB, negligence and obstruction in the administration of justice, as we've learned in the first part of this chapter, these were some of the principal causes that contributed to the success of this widespread insurrection. So there were reasons for this. Yes, Absalom was a jerk, but David was negligent and immoral when you consider Bathsheba and Uriah the Hittite. 2 Samuel 15:13-15, then a messenger came to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, for otherwise none of us will escape from Absalom. Go in haste, or he will overtake us quickly and bring down calamity on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. Then the king's servants said to the king, behold, your servants are ready to do whatever my lord the king chooses. Now this messenger that came to David and said, you're in a heap of trouble, boy. That could have been one of the 200 men who were ignorant of Absalom's designs as they go down to Hebron, and one of them might have said, whoa, when he finds out, he says, whoa, this is bad, came back and told David. That's a speculation. At any rate, David finds out. that the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. Now, here's some possible reasons that people were defecting from David. This is according to Adam Clark. Number one, David was old or maybe afflicted with illness, and so he could not well attend to the administration of justice in the land. That's a speculation. Possible reason number two for the defections. It appears that the king did not attend to the affairs of state. There were no properly appointed judges in the land, as we just read in verse 3 of this chapter. Absalom would say to people, "See, your claims are good and right, but no man listens to you on the part of the king." Absalom's probably telling the truth there. Third reason why people were defecting, Joab's power was overgrown. He was wicked and insolent, oppressive to the people. Joab was David's general, and David was afraid to execute the laws against him. Reason number four why people were defecting. There were still some partisans of the house of Saul who thought the crown had not been fairly obtained by David. There's always going to be members supporting the old regime. You can read medieval history and see that over and over and over again. So that's the fourth reason. Partisans before the kingdom was united. Partisans of Saul. Fifth reasons that people might be defecting to Absalom is because David was under the displeasure of the Almighty, and I'm sure people knew that he was because of his adultery with Bathsheba and his murder of Uriah. You remember, Nathan had prophesied, "The sword's never going to leave your house, David." You don't believe that prophecy got out? I bet it did. And so people are thinking, well, the sword's going to be in the house of David. Well, he deserves it. Sixth reason, in any state, you're going to have troublesome and disaffected men for whatever reason. Maybe they lost a lawsuit. Maybe the political reasons. David didn't do something that they wanted him to do. Well, these disaffected people can never rest. They're always hoping for something from a change. That's just politics. So that's the sixth reason. Sixth reason for so many defections from David. Seventh reason. Absalom appeared to be the real, and he also was, the undisputed heir to the throne. David could not, in the course of nature, live very long. And as Adam Clark says, quote, "Most people are more disposed to hail the beams of the rising than exult in those of the setting sun." So, people looking for a change. That's why one of the most potent political slogans in American presidential politics is, or in any politics in America, is, "It's time for a change. It's old, it's trite, but it works," because people get tired of their elected officials. At any rate, David, in verse 14, says to all of his servants, "We got to flee." Who are his servants? Well, there were his courtiers, his ministers of state, the officers of his household, the typical people that hang around a court, hang around a king. So David gets ready to run. Now, this is really an amazing thing that a man of such courage and valor would flee so quickly. Of course, David was extremely brave as he was running from Saul, fighting in the wilderness, fighting against the Philistines. When he was king of Judah, then king of the whole country, he was constantly winning. He was on a winning streak. He never lost a battle. And he had some tough odds against him many times. He was a brave man, but now he acts like a coward, totally beaten down. He's intimidated as soon as he heard there was a conspiracy against him. Now, I will say in David's defense, it could be that objectively he looked around and saw that fleeing was the only thing he could do. The political situation had deteriorated so badly that military valor was not going to save him at this point. Now, Jameson Fawcett Brown agrees with that idea. They say, quote, "David, anxious for the preservation of the city which he had beautified and hopeful of a greater support throughout the country, wisely resolved on leaving Jerusalem." But Adam Clark disagrees and says David should have stayed there. Why? Why should David have stayed in Jerusalem? Well, Jerusalem was so strong, even the lame and the blind could defend it. 2 Samuel 5:6. "Now the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land. And they said to David, 'You shall not come in here, but the blind and the lame will turn you away.'" That became sort of like a proverb. The blind and the lame could defend Jerusalem. Well, that's true, but that's defend Jerusalem from external attack. David is also worried about internal enemies. He's got a civil war in his hands. It doesn't matter how strong the walls are. Internal treachery would destroy Jerusalem no matter how strong the city was. And so I think Clark is not reasonable there to say that David should have stayed. I think Jameson Fawcett Brown is right that he got out of town, and I think that he had good reasons to do so, even though it made him look like a coward. I mean, David, this is not his finest hour. He's not as brave as he used to be, but still, I don't think you could say he was a coward. I think he was doing what he had to do. Now, here's some other possible explanations of David's quick flight out of Jerusalem. He seems to take the rebellion as coming from the hand of God. After all, Nathan had prophesied the sword would never leave his house in 2 Samuel 12:10. "The sword will never leave your house," Nathan tells him, "because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own wife." And as he goes, And this kind of cuts against what I just said. He fled because the military situation was so bad. But he doesn't flee like a general head of his troops executing an ordered retreat. He rather acts as a mourner. He weeps. He's going barefoot. He covers his head, as we'll see in just a minute. So he doesn't act like he's a strong, courageous military leader in his retreat. Adam Clark says this is the first time David turned his back to his enemies. Well, hindsight is easy. I think if I were David, I think I would have gathered myself up, acted like a general, and got out of town as he did, but I wouldn't have gone crying, weeping, putting ashes on my head, tearing my clothes, covering my head. I don't think I would have done that. That doesn't look too good, but that's what he did. So we go now to 2 Samuel chapter 15, verses 16 through 18. So the king went out, and all his household with him went out from Jerusalem. But the king left 10 concubines to keep the house. The king went out, and all the people with him, and they stopped at the last house. Now all his servants passed on beside him, all the Cherethites, all the Pelethites, and all the Gittites. 600 men who had come with him from Gath passed on before the king. Now this odd little detail, the king leaving 10 concubines to keep his house, keep his palace, that was to look after the household goods and furniture. John Gill says, one would think that concubines are not going to be able to look after the household goods and furniture in a revolution. But apparently David thought they might, so he left them. Now these concubines are mentioned here, I'm sure, because they're the ones that Absalom is later going to sleep with on the roof of the palace where everybody can see, as an ultimate insult to David's authority. We'll see that later on, not in this chapter. Now David, by leaving the concubines, must have forgotten about Nathan's prophecy to him in 2 Samuel 12:11. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you from your own household. I will even take your wives before your eyes and give them to your companion, and he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. The concubine is a junior wife, so this is what the prophecy referred to. David must have forgotten that prophecy. I'm not surprised that he would forget that. He goes to the last house. That's on the edge of Jerusalem as you head toward the Kidron Valley, which is the valley on the east of Jerusalem between the city of David, Mount Zion, and the Mount of Olives. Mount of Olives to the east, city of David to the west. When it says in verse 17 that David had come to the last house, we know he hasn't crossed the Kidron yet, because in verse 23, a few verses later in this chapter, we see the king also passed over the brook Kidron. So they hadn't gone very far. Adam Clark says David probably had stopped to make sure that all of his friends had gotten safely out of Jerusalem. Now, some of the people that went with David were the Cherethites and the Pelethites. Now, I love the mention of these Cherethites and Pelethites. This is not the first time they've been mentioned. It's because nobody knows what they are, and there's so many speculations, it's almost humorous. So I'm going to run through them real quick. They could have been the king's bodyguards. They could have been two prominent families in Israel. They could have been two factions in the Sanhedrin. They could have been archers and slingers. They could have been two different nationalities, the Cherethites being Philistines and the Pelethites from a place called Pelet. So, or it could be the Cherethites were those who accompanied David as he fled from Saul when he ran around in the wilderness, and then the Pelethites were those who came to David while he was at Ziklag. Or the last speculation, Cherethites were executioners and Pelethites were couriers. That's Easton's Dictionary's view. And I'm not going to read what they say about that. So at any rate, they were prominent in the kingdom. They left, and all the Gittites. Gittite means somebody that's from Gath, that famous Philistine city to the west of Jerusalem, north and west of Jerusalem, on the Shephelah, the plain. Now here's some speculations as to what was the origin of the Gittites. They could have come from David, with David from Gath when David had conquered Gath, quoting 2 Samuel 8:1, after this David defeated and crushed the Philistines, he took control of the main Philistine city from them, and of course you have to assume the main Philistine is Gath, and then they became proselytes, and so they're with him now. So they could have been originally Philistines who had converted over to the Jewish religion as proselytes, or they could have been Israelites themselves who were Israelites who called themselves Gittites, because they had stayed with David in Gath when David had fled from Saul. We read in 1 Samuel 27:2, so David arose and crossed over, he and the men who were with him, to Achish, king of Gath. Remember that. He went to Achish twice, actually. He went to Gath twice. First time he was in Gath, Achish's counselor said, you can't trust this guy, and so David had to pretend like he was crazy so that people would leave him alone, and he got out. The second time he went to Achish, he convinced Achish that he was safe, but Achish sent him down to the city of Ziklag in the southwest, and David then proceeded to do a lot of damage to Achish's friends without Achish's knowledge. But at any rate, there were 600 men that went with David when that happened, and so that's who these Gittites could have been. They could have been Israelites who were called Gittites because they fled with David to Gath. I think that's probably what it is, to be honest with you. Third option is it was a special military band of a set number, and they were called Gittites in honor of the 600 faithful Israelites that I just mentioned, the ones that fled with David to Gath. At any rate, all of David's supporters in verse 15 said, "Behold, we are ready to do whatever the Lord the King, my Lord the King, chooses." And so dropping down to 2 Samuel 15, verses 19 through 20, we continue, "Then the king said to Ittai the Gittite, 'Why will you also go with us? Return and remain with the king, for you are a foreigner and also an exile.'" And that king there is referring to Absalom. "For you are a foreigner and also an exile. Return to your own place. You came only yesterday, and shall I today make you wander with us while I go where I will? Return and take back your brothers. Mercy and truth be with you." Some people think that this Ittai, the Gittite, was the son of Achish, who was the king of Gath, the same Achish I just mentioned. And when Achish turned on David the first time, when David had to pretend he was insane to get out, the theory is that Achish sent his son into exile into Israel. Nice speculation. At any rate, David tells Ittai to go back. In other words, to go back to Absalom, to be on the other side. Now, why would David be asking someone to go to the other side when David's numbers were not very large? Jameson Fawcett Brown says it's because he's testing Ittai's loyalty. Now, if this Gittite was originally a Philistine who had lived in Gath and had come over to Israel, I can understand why David might be wanting to test his loyalty. But if he was a Gittite who was an original Israelite who had gone with David to Gath in his exile, those are pretty loyal people. And besides, it says here, "You are a foreigner and also an exile." That sounds like he is a Philistine, a foreigner, and David's testing his loyalty. Now, here's an interesting question. Why would David tell Ittai, go and remain with the king? The king? Why would David call Absalom a king when Absalom wasn't king yet? Well, the Holman Christian Study Bible inserts a word into the text to make that make some sense. It says this, "The king said to Ittai the Gittite," this is verse 19, 2 Samuel 15, Holman Christian Study Bible, "The king said to Ittai the Gittite, 'Why are you also going with us? Go back and stay with the new king.'" The new is in brackets. It's not in the text, in the original text. "Go back and stay with the new king since you're both a foreigner and an exile from your homeland." Well, that's one option. David's just referring to him as the new king. The NIV Study Bible says that this is reasonable because it appeared to David that Absalom had actually replaced David. We already know in verse 13 of this chapter, a messenger had come to David saying, "The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom." And so David figures, yep, I've lost my kingdom. I've lost my monarchy. We have a new king now. It's Absalom. David knew that Hebron had acknowledged Absalom's revolt. By now he knew it. David by now knew that 200 leading men of Israel had gone over to Absalom, as we read in verse 11. Plus, David had surrendered the capital city by leaving it, Jerusalem. Yeah, there's a new king in town. So that's why he calls him the king. But even though David called Absalom the king, of course, David had not given up the chance of getting his kingdom back yet. As we'll see, he's going to engage in some spy work. We go to 2 Samuel 15, verses 21 through 23. "But Ittai answered the king and said, 'As the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives,'" that's an oath, "'surely, wherever my lord the king may be, whether for death or for life, there also your servant will be.'" A strong protestation of loyalty there. "Therefore David said to Ittai, 'Go and pass over,'" meaning pass over the Kidron Brook and go over to the Mount of Olives. "So Ittai the Gittite passed over with all his men and all the little ones who were with him. While all the country was weeping with a loud voice, all the people passed over." Again, passed over the Kidron Valley. "The king also," and the Kidron Valley had a brook in it, the brook Kidron. That brook had water in it when it wasn't summertime, but now it's probably sometime after the barley harvest, in April, which occurred in April or May. Remember, Absalom had recently burnt down Joab's barley to get Joab to come talk to him. That was a while back. Could have been 4 years ago. So I don't guess that really tells us what time of the year it is now. But we can speculate that the brook was probably dry and easy to cross over. And if you're going to start a rebellion, what's the best time to do it? In the wintertime or in the spring or summertime? Absalom starts that rebellion. It's probably spring. It's probably summertime. And so there's probably no brook there. So it was easy for the people to pass over. toward the way of the wilderness. I assume that means the scrubby area of land in the Kidron Valley. We go down to 2 Samuel chapter 15, verse 24. Now behold, Zadok also came, and all the Levites with him, carrying the Ark of the Covenant of God. And they set down the Ark of God, and Abiathar came up until all the people had finished passing from the city. Now we're going to see here in just a minute that Zadok and Abiathar were the two co-high priests at the time. Under the entry for Zadok, gotquestions.org says that, quote, Zadok, son of Ahitub, was a Levite priest during the time of King David. For a long time, he was co-high priest with Abiathar. Well, this mention of Zadok and Abiathar shows that the priests and the Levites were still with David. So the revolution wasn't complete yet. Absalom didn't have the priests and Levites. And, of course, the Levites who were responsible for carrying the ark were the Kohathite Levites. That was the particular family that carried the ark. The ark had been stored in David's special tent that David had built for the ark in Jerusalem when it had returned from Kiriath-Jearim. And so the Kohathites are now carrying the ark outside of Jerusalem. And that's not surprising that they would do that. There's going to be a change of heart in just a minute, but for right now the ark is coming out. So Zadok, the Kohath priest, the Levites, Abiathar, they all carrying the ark of God, and they came up. That probably means they came up to the top of the Mount of Olives, because that's where everybody's going. All of David's people are going right now. They came up there until all the people had finished passing from the city. So they were up there watching as the sad procession came out of the city. Now, it doesn't say when it says came up. It doesn't say that Zadok and Abiathar and the Levites and the ark and so forth were at the top of the Mount of Olives. But we can infer that because of verse 30, which we'll get to in just a minute. David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives and wept as he went. So if David went there, we can assume everybody else went there too. We go now to 2 Samuel chapter 15, verses 25 and 26. Then the king instructed Zadok, "Return the ark of God to the city. If I find favor in the Lord's eyes, he will bring me back and allow me to see both it, the ark, and its dwelling place. However, if he should say, I do not delight in you, then here I am. He can do with me whatever pleases him." Now, why would David send the ark and the priest ministering to the ark with the ark? Why would he send them back to Jerusalem? Well, here's some speculations. First, from Gill and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. David knew that Absalom wouldn't dare to attack the ark and the priest. Of course he wouldn't. Jerusalem was the proper place for the ark. The ark would be exposed to danger wandering around outside of Jerusalem. And besides, the priests going back into Jerusalem, they're still loyal to David. They could keep David informed of developments inside Jerusalem. Now, John Gill has an off-the-wall speculation, as he often does. He said that David couldn't bear to carry around the law, which was in the ark. David couldn't bear to carry around that law because the law denounced adultery and murder. And David had committed adultery and murder with Bathsheba and Uriah the Hittite. I don't think so. David's already been forgiven and written Psalm 51 by now. Adam Clark thinks that maybe David is worried about the population of Jerusalem. Public worship could not be carried on without the ark, he says. Well, I don't know if that's true, but before the ark came from Kiriath-Jearim, they didn't have any public worship. I guess it would be easier, let's put it that way, to have public worship with the ark there in Jerusalem. David says, if he finds favor, God will send him back, and he will see not only the ark, but the ark's dwelling place. Well, what is the ark's dwelling place? Well, it could be Jerusalem, but I think most probably it's the special tent that David had built for the ark. We see that in 2 Samuel 6:17. So they brought in the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent which David had pitched for it. If you recall, this is a different tent than the tabernacle. The tabernacle was still at Gibeon to the northwest of Jerusalem. So David's saying, maybe I'll get back to see the ark if God delights in me. But then he said, what if he doesn't delight in me? I'm just going to stay here and see what he does with me. Well, I'm sure that what David is thinking here, if God delights in me temporally as a king for what I've done as a king, he will let me keep my kingdom. Now, if God doesn't delight in him, that doesn't mean that David thinks that God might turn his back on David forever. It just means that God would take his kingdom away. It's a temporal thing, not an eternal thing. Well, I wouldn't be surprised that David thought that God might not be delighted in him, because he's not exactly been flying straight here lately. The incident with Bathsheba and Uriah is pretty bad, and he's suffering for it right now, punishment, according to Nathan's prophecy. We go now to 2 Samuel 15, verses 27 through 29. The king said also to Zadok the priest, "Are you not a seer? Return to the city in peace, and your two sons with you, your son Ahimaaz and Jonathan, the son of Abiathar. See, I am going to wait at the fords of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me. Therefore Zadok and Abiathar returned the Ark of God to Jerusalem and remained there. Now, I mentioned earlier that Zadok and Abiathar were the two co-high priests of Israel at this time. Zadok was from the line of Eleazar, and Abiathar was from the line of Ithamar. If you recall, Aaron, the original high priest, had four sons, Nadab and Abihu, got killed for offering strange fire. The next son was Eleazar. He was the high priest all the way through the wilderness after the tabernacle was built up, right before they went in, or maybe right after they crossed the Jordan River. I don't think it's very clear, but then at some point in the history, Ithamar takes, the descendants of Ithamar take over. Now, instead of relying on my memory, let's read the entry from the ATS Bible Dictionary, a new one. I've never used it before. Quote, Saul, it would appear, had transferred the dignity of the high priesthood from the line of Ithamar, to which Eli belonged. Well, that's where I was. Eli, of course, lost the ark to the Philistines because of his two deadbeat sons, Hophni and Phinehas. And so, apparently, after that happened, by the time that Saul took over the kingdom, he transferred the office of priest upon Zadok. The ATS Bible Dictionary continues, Thus there were at the same time two high priests in Israel, Abiathar with David and Zadok with Saul. If you recall, Abiathar had fled from Nob when Saul got Doeg the Edomite to kill all the priests up there. I think it was 85 of them. One of them escaped, and that was Abiathar, and he took over the high priesthood, and he traveled with David while he was on the run in the wilderness from Saul, and he was still the high priest during David's time, where we are now. And Zadok was the high priest when Saul had appointed him, and so when the two kingdoms merged, well, we're not going to cause any political upheaval. We're going to have two high priests, Abiathar and Zadok. ATS Bible Dictionary continues, This double priesthood continued from the death of Ahimelech till the reign of Solomon. The death of Ahimelech, I think, is referring to the massacre of the priest at Nob. So anyway, this dual priesthood lasted till Solomon's reign, after which the office was held by Zadok and his race alone, his descendants alone. Now, David had good reasons for putting the ark back in Jerusalem, as I said, but also he's going to put the priests back in Jerusalem, and he's going to use them for spies. He says to Zadok, his first spy, Are you not a seer? A seer was a seeing one, one who sees, a seer, a seeing, knowing man, one who can penetrate into men and things. And as such, it might be better for David to have him in Jerusalem so Zadok could let him know what's going on and give him advice. He was also a priest, so he could perform public worship, which I'm sure David wanted to keep going. Now, the two high priests had two sons. Ahimaaz is the son of Zadok, and Jonathan is the son of the other high priest, Abiathar. Now, Ahimaaz and Jonathan did not go all the way into Jerusalem. They stopped and stayed at En-Rogel, just outside of Jerusalem. There's a famous spring there at En-Rogel. It's right there on the eastern slope of the city of David, Mount Zion, right as you descend into the Kidron Valley. We know they stopped and stayed there because of 2 Samuel 17, verse 17. Now, Jonathan and Ahimaaz were staying at En-Rogel, and a maidservant would go and tell them, and they would go and tell King David, for they could not be seen entering the city. So there are your two spies, or three actually, Zadok and his son Ahimaaz and Abiathar. Well, four, I guess you count Zadok and his son Ahimaaz and Abiathar and his son Jonathan. They're going to let David know what's going on inside the city. So I guess David is not completely giving up here. He's doing something good here. He wants to be informed, it says in verse 28. Informed of what? Did the conspiracy really happen? Is it true that Absalom has rebelled against me? If he did, how many conspirators does he have exactly? Who are these conspirators? What progress have they made? Have they arrived in Jerusalem from Hebron yet? If so, what are they doing in Jerusalem? That sort of thing. We go now to 2 Samuel 15, verses 30 and 31. And David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives and wept as he went, and his head was covered, and he walked barefoot. Then all the people who were with him each covered his head and went up weeping as they went. Now someone told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, I pray, make the counsel of Ahithophel foolishness. Well, David's crying as he walks up the Mount of Olives. He had a lot to cry about. His son Absalom was a murderer and a traitor to his kingdom. David had lost his kingdom. David was homeless. He was living in a palace before. Now he's homeless. He was probably also very conscious that his sins were the cause of all these troubles. So yeah, he's crying all right. His head was covered as he walked up the Mount of Olives. As the NIV Study Bible says, in Israel, the uncovered head was a sign of man's honor, pride, and freedom before God. And, of course, a covered head is exactly the opposite. It has the opposite meaning. Dishonor, shame, slavery. This reminds me of that verse in 1 Corinthians 11:7, for a man ought not to have his head covered, since he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of man. The idea of, you often wonder, what is a Jew wearing a head covering, what is a Corinthian wearing a head covering in the worship service for? Well, because covered heads back then apparently meant humility and lack of leadership and subjection and all. That argument would be much stronger if the Corinthians were Jews that Paul was writing to, but he was writing to Greeks. They might not have had the same opinion, but maybe they did. But at any rate, in David's time, covering the head meant a loss of freedom and extreme humiliation. And that, of course, was a thing of great sorrow. So the covering became a symbol of mourning. And now while he's crying and walking, he gets some more bad news. Ahithophel, your major counselor, he's gone over to Absalom. We read that in verse 12 already. Adam Clark says, quote, Ahithophel was a wise man and well-versed in state affairs, and God alone could confound his devices. And that's why David said, O Lord, I pray, make the counsel of Ahithophel foolishness. As we'll see here in just a minute, that's exactly what happened. God answered David's prayer. Well, we won't see it because it's two chapters from now in 2 Samuel 17:14. Then Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. For the Lord had ordained to thwart the good counsel of Ahithophel so that the Lord might bring calamity on Absalom. We'll see it when we get there. There was different strategies advised, and Ahithophel had the good strategy, and Hushai, David's friend, who was a spy sent by David into the counsels of Absalom, he had a bad strategy to make Absalom screw up, and Absalom took Hushai's advice and used the bad strategy, which allowed David to get his act together. And so God did thwart the counsel of Ahithophel and made it foolishness. It didn't mean that Ahithophel's counsel was foolish, but as God worked out the circumstances, the counsel of Ahithophel turned into foolishness because Absalom took Hushai the Archite's advice instead of Ahithophel's wise advice. We go now to 2 Samuel 15, verses 32 through 37, and we will finish up this chapter. It happened as David was coming to the summit, and that's the summit of the Mount of Olives, where God was worshipped, that behold, Hushai the Archite met him with his coat torn and dust on his head. David said to him, if you pass over with me, then you will be a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in time past, so I will now be your servant. Then you can thwart the counsel of Ahithophel for me. Are not Zadok and Abiathar the priests with you there? So it shall be that whatever you hear from the king's house, you shall report to Zadok and Abiathar the priest. Behold, their two sons are with them there, Ahimaaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son, and by them you shall send me everything that you hear. So Hushai, David's friend, came into the city, and Absalom came into Jerusalem, coming up from Hebron. Now there's a textual translation problem here in verse 32. David was coming to the summit of the Mount of Olives where God was worshipped. The KJV has where he worshipped God. The NIV and the NASB have came to the summit where God was worshipped. The Holman Christian Study Bible and the New American Bible have David came to the summit where he used to worship God. And God's Word translation, the one that I'm going to buy here, says he came to the summit where people worshipped God. And Ellicott states, quote, this translation should be rather where men worship. The original indicates a customary act. David had taken the road over the crest of the Mount of Olives, and there in all probability was one of those high places which abounded in Israel. In other words, it was a high place. That's just an incidental detail thrown in there by the author. If the KJV is right and David goes up there and worships God, then that is probably where he composed and sung Psalm 3, the header of which says a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. I'll give you verse 1 of that psalm. It says this, O Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me. Oh, yes, sir. Well, David has sinned greatly, but he was always turning back to God in his grief. It's a good thing. Good thing to repent. Contrite heart. God loves a contrite heart. Now, Hushai, the Archite, sees David up on the Mount of Olives, and Hushai had his coat torn and dust on his head, typical signs of mourning. He's loyal to David. He's probably an inhabitant of Archite. He's called the Archite. The Archi probably lay on the borders of Ephraim. Joshua 16:2 mentions the border of the Archites near Ataroth. I looked up Ataroth Adar on the map. It's on the border between Ephraim and Benjamin as you go north on the road from Jerusalem. You go through Gibeah, and then you go to Ramah. And just north of Ramah is this Ataroth Adar, and Archi is probably near there somewhere. Now, Ataroth Adar, north of Ramah, has a question mark on it in BibleAtlas.org's map, but that's all right. And Ataroth Adar is said by BibleAtlas.org to refer to Joshua 16:2, which I just read, where the Archites are supposed to have a border. So all of that is a bunch of detail about where Hushai was from. It's not very important, but Hushai is apparently close to Jerusalem. He's from the area. In other words, he's very loyal to David. Now, I mentioned that the sons of Zadok, Ahimaaz, and the son of Zadok, Ahimaaz, and the son of Abiathar, Jonathan, they stayed in Rogel, which is the spring right outside the city on the slopes of the Kidron, of the slopes of the city of David going down into the Kidron Valley on the slopes of Mount Zion. They would stay there, and then Hushai, Zadok, and Abiathar, who were in the city, they will then relay messages to those two boys, to those two sons, and those two sons will then head on across the Kidron Valley up on the Mount of Olives and give the messages to David. Now, when Absalom came into the city in verse 37, let me read verse 37. So Hushai, David's friend, came into the city, and Absalom came into Jerusalem. Absalom came into Jerusalem just as Hushai entered the city. Absalom didn't even know Hushai had left. 2 Samuel 16, verse 17 says this, Absalom said to Hushai, "Is this your loyalty to your friend? Why did you not go with your friend?" Meaning your friend David. "What do you mean? You're defecting from David and you're coming over to my side?" He's a little bit suspicious. So apparently Absalom didn't even know Hushai had left the city with David. If he had known that, he probably wouldn't have taken him into his council. So that worked out very well for David, because now Absalom would have no reason to suspect Hushai's loyalty. So ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with this very long chapter, chapter 15, of all 37 verses. We're now ready to go into chapter 16. In chapter 16, verses 1 through 23, we will see Absalom entering Jerusalem and David's activities on the eastern side of the Jordan River as he tries to deal with the bad situation. Hope to see you next time, and hope you enjoyed this audio.